Good morning. It's 11 minutes before 8 a.m. This is Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. Today is Thursday, November 21st, 2013. I'm Melissa Marconi-Wenzel with Raven News. In the back of most Sitkans' mind is this question. When the big wave hits, will my house be underwater? Researchers at the Alaska Earthquake Information Center have an answer of sorts. This month, they released a new map outlining which parts of Sitka would be affected by a major tsunami. KCAW's Rachel Woldholtz reports on what they found.
On January 4th of this year, just before midnight, Sitkans woke up to feel the ground shaking beneath them. Then they heard the tsunami siren, warning everyone to get to high ground.
I think the thing that got people excited about it was is we actually felt the quake and they heard the siren. And we hadn't heard the siren in probably 20 years.
That's Fire Chief Dave Miller, who's responsible for setting off the tsunami siren. In the end, there was no wave, but for many people, it was a wake-up call. What would happen if a big wave did come? This month, researchers released a new map that tries to answer that question. It shows the state's best estimate for how far inland the water would reach and how deep it would be in a worst-case scenario tsunami. Miller studies a copy of the map in his office.
Lincoln Street seems to be sort of the dividing line through town. Everything in the water side would have 3 to 6 feet of water somewhere in there.
So Centennial Hall is underwater, and Crescent Harbor is swamped. But the good news is that most of Sitka is above the high water line.
And where we're standing right now at the fire department.
Fire department, we'd be fine. We'd be sitting high and dry and wouldn't have our fishing poles out yet.
And it's not just the fire hall. Some places that seem very low, like the airport and C-Mart supermarket, are above the inundation line. And most of Sitka's main roadways, like Sawmill Creek Road and Halibut Point Road, are also above the high water mark, protected by steep bedrock along the coast. The map is the result of a computer model.
It's pretty boring, but I've been studying tsunamis all my life.
Elena Suleimani is a tsunami modeler at the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, and it's her model that the new map is based on. She says that for Sitka, the worst-case scenario, the scenario on which the map is based, would be a big earthquake on the subduction fault that stretches from Kodiak to Prince William Sound. That fault produced the 1964 tsunami that put Anchorage underwater. Closer to home, the Queen Charlotte Fault, which got Sitkans out of bed in January, is a strike-slip fault. The plates are sliding past each other instead of colliding head-on. And during earthquakes, they don't produce the kind of vertical motion that makes for big waves. They can, however, cause landslides, both on land and underwater. These landslides, in turn, can cause their own waves, and it's almost impossible to model them. That's in part because they occur along smaller faults that haven't been studied. This is Rich Kohler, who works with Suleimani.
We haven't looked at these. Nobody has. Partially because they're covered in, you know, it's rugged terrain, covered in forests, it's hard to get to. Where do you start? Anyway, there's nothing known about these faults, how often earthquakes happen on them. How big they could be, nothing.
But Suleimani and Kohler say that the largest wave caused by a landslide would still be smaller than the worst-case scenario plotted on the map. So, at the end of the day, what's the takeaway? According to Suleimani, no matter what the map says, if you feel the ground shake, go uphill.
If you are in the coastal area and you feel ground shaking, just get uphill immediately. Don't wait for any official announcement. Don't wait for sirens. Just go uphill. And stay there. Usually the advice is to stay there at least for 24 hours.
Sitka Fire Chief Dave Miller says the key point is to know ahead of time where you're going and be ready to go at a moment's notice, something many Sitkans weren't prepared for in January.
You get, 9,000 people trying to move all at one time. It's a zoo at best. There's a lot of cars. There were cars going hither and yon at any given time on the street in front of the fire hall.
Miller thinks people should take a close look at the map. He also thinks they should take it with a grain of salt.
The thing that you got to remember is this, this is a computer-generated map. In Japan, they had the same thing. They did the same studies, had the same results, and said, not much is going to happen if we ever have an earthquake here. And they had the earthquake, and Mother Nature said, get ready, I'm coming.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
You can find a link to the tsunami inundation map on our website, kcaw.org. Or you can check out hard copy versions of the maps at the Sitka Fire Hall or City Hall. The Sitka Sound Science Center prematurely released some coho salmon smolt this month in order to prevent the spread of infection throughout its hatchery. The hatchery's water supply, which is fed by the nearby Indian River, was compromised by the huge numbers of dying pink salmon this fall. The release created a minor feeding frenzy on Sitka's waterfront as birds and other predators descended on the smolt. KCAW's Rich McClear stopped by the Science Center to check on the commotion and to learn more about the timing of the salmon release.
There was a congregation of birds, seagulls, ravens, crows, even a heron, all around the outflow of the Science Center hatchery. I saw one raven holding what looked like a baby salmon. But salmon are released in the spring. What was happening? I went to the Science Center to find out. A worker there told me they had just released thousands of smolt, or baby salmon. But why? The next day I found Lon Garrison, aquaculture director for the Sitka Sound Science Center.
We recently had to release some smolt that we had tried to hold on for a second year and release as two-year-olds. And we had to let those go because they were developing some health issues with a naturally occurring disease called bacterial kidney disease. The Indian River system has bacterial kidney disease in it as a natural pathogen.
The hatchery was trying to hold on to the smolt for an extra year because the summer's weak return of coho did not produce enough eggs for next spring. Garrison hoped that by releasing these baby fish in the spring of 2014, he would improve the subsequent runs. But that didn't work out as well as he had hoped. Bacterial kidney disease, or BKD, exists all along the West Coast, but it was a particularly bad year for Indian River, in part because it was such a good summer.
This year we actually had some of the worst water quality that I've ever seen coming into any hatchery. The water for the SJ hatchery comes directly out of Indian River. And, of course, this year, Indian River had a phenomenal return of pink salmon. Probably somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 pink salmon returned, which is close to three or four times what the escapement goal would be. So we were well over what we should have had. But what that translated to this year, especially with a low water year, where we didn't have a lot of rain, we ended up with a tremendous biomass in the river, and they were using up oxygen like crazy. So the dissolved oxygen in the water that was coming to the hatchery was the lowest I've ever seen.
The low oxygen level weakened the fish's immune systems. The huge numbers of dying fish introduced unusual amounts of fungus and bacteria into the hatchery's water supply. The hatchery could have tried antibiotics, but Garrison said a better choice was to release the fish before the bacteria spread further in the close quarters of the rearing pens.
When those fish are reared in an intense situation like they are in a hatchery, the mortality can just continue to increase. So the best course of action is really to let those guys go. And so they got an early release. November is not a general time when we try and release fish. Obviously, there's not a lot of food necessarily in the ocean at that time. And there's a lot of predators around at the end of the season. So we like to normally release those fish in the spring. But we had to do it a little earlier than planned.
So does that mean those smolt are a loss? Garrison doesn't necessarily think so.
I'm still hopeful that we'll still see some coho come back, even from this release. I mean, the majority of the fish were very healthy. They were a good size, nearly twice the size of the fish that were released in the spring. They were pretty chubby, so they have a lot of energy reserves. So I think if they can escape the predators and they didn't come down with the kidney disease, they probably should do just fine.
That was Lon Garrison, aquaculture director for the Sitka Sound Science Center. Garrison says now that the fish are released, they will disinfect their pens with bleach and try again next year. In Sitka, I'm Rich McClear.
The federal government has finalized new guidelines on the use of sea otters by Alaska Natives. The change is aimed at better defining a requirement that hides must be significantly altered in order to be considered authentic Native handicrafts or clothing that can be sold to non-Natives. Andrea Medeiros is a spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has been working on the revised wording for more than a year.
These are guidelines, and they're to help the Alaska Native artisans to understand what exactly qualifies as significantly altered.
The final guidelines say a sea otter will be considered significantly altered when it's not recognizable as a whole hide and has been made into handicrafts or clothing. The language goes on to define that in more detail. It's a positive step, according to the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, which teaches classes in the native tradition of skin sewing. SHI Chief Operating Officer Lee Katinger says the new wording still needs some adjustment, but overall, he says SHI appreciates the change. Katinger thinks it helps clear up a term that he says has caused significant harm to artisans over the years.
Clarifying significantly altered to more align with the Marine Mammal Protection Act's original intent this language is going to help continue a tradition practice since time immemorial without fear of prosecution, as has been in past. Protecting this inherent cultural right is not only good public policy, but it supports and preserves cultural diversity and respects the traditions and lifestyles of Alaska Native people.
The Fish and Wildlife Service's new definition of significantly altered is very similar to language endorsed last year by the Alaska Federation of Natives. That's with the exception of a line requiring that an otter skin be changed enough that it cannot be easily converted back to an unaltered hide or a piece of hide. Sea otters are a federally protected species, and only coastal Alaska Natives are allowed to hunt them. The revised language was, in part, prompted by concerns that unclear regulations and past informant actions had discouraged Native use of the animals. According to the agency, the final guidelines are based on input from a 2012 workshop with Native artisans and hunters, as well as extensive public comments on draft language that came out last spring. Some commenters had found the draft language too restrictive. Others opposed the change as an attempt to weaken protections and encourage more hunting of the animals which have come into conflict with some of Alaska's fisheries. That's all for Raven News for this morning. It's 8 a.m. This is KCAW Sitka. We're going to rejoin National Public Radio. I'll be back with you at 18 minutes after with a local interview.